Lord, thanks for the opportunity to get together, and I want to thank you for the beautiful fall weather. It's so neat to have rain, and just one of the amazing things about living in Tahoe, Father, is just the change of seasons, and just a neat and beautiful thing, and we thank you for your creation we get to enjoy. Lord, I want to just lift up to you all the Nicaragua folks, and especially the people from our church, and ask God that you'd watch over them, not only give them traveling mercies, but I also just ask, Father, that this would be just a trip where they'd be blessed by the people that they meet and the work that they get to do. And I pray that they'd be a blessing for the folks that they're going to do some work for. I pray they'd come back with amazing stories of your faithfulness and your goodness and how you challenged them, and that those stories could inspire us. Thanks for the opportunity and the freedom we have to get together, and just ask that you bless our time together tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, they say that there are two things that no family should talk about, and that is God and politics. And we are taking the dive here at church. We talk about a lot of controversial things. We're going to spend some time talking about God and government over the next 4 weeks. And I'm going to kick things off tonight talking about, you know, what was God's original intent with governing his creation. And then next week, John's going to come, and John's going to spend some time talking about, well, what does the Bible say about civil government, and what does it tell us about it, and what's its purpose, and you know, how do we play our part in what God orchestrates here on earth via civil governments? In 2 weeks, Dan is going to come. He's going to spend some time talking about how we're sort of citizens. We've got like a passport, and we are naturalized citizens to some degree of two kingdoms, God's kingdom, but also here. And so, what does it look like to serve our heavenly King here in a different kingdom? What's that look like for us to be faithful here where we're living? And then in 3 weeks, I'll come back and I'm going to spend some time talking about our unique history as a country and what it tells us about how we can have a voice in the world where we live today. Sort of comes out of a presentation that I used to do when I was in high school. When I was a youth pastor, I'd go to the local high school, is what I meant to say, and it was a really cool opportunity. The seniors, when they were taking classes, one of the classes all seniors had to take was civics. And so I got to go to the local high school and do a debate with a local lawyer and about separation of church and state. And it was an amazing educational opportunity for me, and a really challenging subject to talk about. One of the things that was always fascinating to me, you know, I was thinking back, you know, the first couple times I went, I was thinking about, well, what was it like when I was in high school in civics class, when I wasn't getting thrown out of class for screwing around in class, you know, but when I was actually in class and the teachers left me in there, I thought, I didn't learn anything, and I was zoned out, and I wasn't paying any attention. I was, you know, making fun of, laughing, whoever the substitute or guest speaker was, and I thought, oh man, this is going to be my payback. And so I went, and I was amazed, because I don't know if it's just the subject matter or what, but the kids always, I mean, they were really curious, and they had a lot of really challenging questions. There were a couple times where we came back the following week and did some more question and answer stuff, because the kids had so many good questions about this. They recognize that, you know, if you, whatever your religious inclinations are, they sometimes come in conflict with the government where you live. And so, you know, they'd ask me questions like, well, is a human government, is it really necessary? And we talk about that. They would ask, well, why is there a separation of church and state? Is it a good thing? What are the extents of it? You know, a big question was always, how do you resolve conflicts when those two things come into conflict? One of the questions that we always spent a lot of time talking about, and this I think shows you how well the kids were thinking, is they'd ask the question, well, if God's in control of everything, including civil governments, why have there been so many corrupt leaders and regimes throughout the history of the world? So, man, we had some amazing discussions, and I'll dive into a little bit about what our founder's intent was in 3 weeks. But tonight, like I said, I'm going to start just by talking about what was God's original intent? Because you read in the book of Genesis, if you go back right to the beginning, it doesn't say, you know, on the fifth day God instituted human government. But there's no doubt that God does govern his creation. So what did that look like? And you can find the answers to it, I think, relatively easily by just going to the very first chapter of the Bible. And that's what I want to do, is just take a quick sketch of Genesis chapter 1 and see what it tells us about God and the governing of his creation. And the one thing I was thinking about this afternoon when I was waking up from my nap is I was thinking about how, you know, if you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and you look and you see, well, what was God's original intent for governing his creation? One of the things that is clear is at the end of Genesis 1, God's thrilled with the way things are, right? What does it say? He's created at the end of each day. It says it was very good. He was pleased with how things were progressing along. And then he makes man, and what does he say? He says it's very good. God was thrilled when at the end of Genesis chapter 1 with the creation and how he had set things up and what things looked like. So the first thing I think we recognize, you have your notes, you can pull them out and follow along. The first thing I think we recognize is you read through Genesis chapter 1 is that, look, it's the big part of the purpose of Genesis 1 is to tell us what? God is the creator. This wasn't an accident. He had an intent and a purpose, a design in what he was doing. And he's not an absentee landlord that makes it and then just comes and checks in every once in a while. But he's always exercised oversight over his creation, even when things got really, really messy. And not only that, but there's an amazing order. There's this intricacy to what he made and how it all works together. I was watching, you know, Discovery Channel with my kids a couple months ago, and they were doing a thing on the rainforest and just talking about, I mean, talk about a place where life just thrives. It's incredible. And the diversity of life there. And it all fits together. The things work together in this amazing harmony in the rainforest. And the thing is if you take out any one of the major components out of that system, what happens? The whole thing breaks down. I was talking with somebody this week in my college group just about anatomy and physiology, and they're taking some classes. If you believe in naturalism, you believe in evolution, look, we all have our own free will, and you can come to whatever conclusions you want and whatever the scientific evidence points to. But, you know, the student who's taking these classes, and he was learning about your eyes and how incredibly complex your eyes are. And he was saying to me, just, it was a wow factor for him as he's sitting in this anatomy physiology class going, whoa, people actually believe that this thing just happened? You give enough time and something like that can develop? You know, and he was dumbfounded that he used to believe that and that people hold on to that belief. But the complexity of our bodies and how we work, it's unbelievable. And see, here's the thing. If there's an easy answer for it, if you believe the Genesis account, it says it's a creative mastermind God who's behind all of this complexity, and he made it for a purpose to reflect who he is and his complexity and his goodness and his beauty. That's why we have all of this. The second thing I think you come to when you read Genesis chapter 1 is that there's this really amazing place for man in the universe. God's got this special role for us that is, it's unique and different from anything else that he created. And we talk about this all the time that, you know, part of what is amazing about a human is that, you know, we're physical. We're material. We're made from the dust of the earth. Genesis, you know, says that's how God brought Adam to life. But, you know, we all know, I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. I think everybody recognizes, whether you believe in a God or not, you believe in a creation account or not, everybody, I think, recognizes that there is more to you than just the physical makeup of your body. And Genesis says that God breathed life, his spirit, into us. And I think we all recognize at some level that we're more than just the sum of all of our material parts. And so man is this amazing creation. Now, here's the thing. Genesis tells us that man has a unique job on earth, an expectation that we would rule, that we would govern this place where we live. Genesis 1:26 says, "Then the Lord said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness." And right away, I think that there's a clue there about about how we're supposed to operate. We were made in His image, so I think that to some extent, God has an expectation that we would reflect Him and His character and His conduct. Let them rule over all of the earth and all of the creatures that move along the ground. Amazing job that God gives us. It's interesting because that Hebrew word, you know, people translate it a lot of different ways. Rule, the Message Bible uses the word responsible. It calls on that word like stewardship. Like, you've been given this place? Take good care of it, right? That's sort of the way the Message renders that. The New Living says, you know, it's like reign. I think the best word is dominion, that we have some given authority to make or use those resources as we please. We have an incredible amount of latitude that God's given us to take whatever resources you have at your disposal. And there isn't a person in here that doesn't have some resources at their expense that they can do something with. And God says, take whatever resources you have and make something of the earth. That was God's original, you know, words that He told Adam. It's interesting, this Hebrew word, I was reading this week, that the Hebrew word in here, dominion, it also means to like take a hard, you know, for them it would have been like a piece of pottery, and scrape out, you know, force, make, shape something. And you know what I thought of when I was reading that? I thought, you know what I think He's saying? I think that God is saying, leave your mark here on earth. Take the resources that I've given you. Take the natural gifts that I've given you. And every person in here has got different gifts at their disposal that God gave you. They're yours. He says, make something. Make a mark in the world. Make something that represents some of the creative potential that I've given you. Do something good with it. I think the third thing that we recognize in Genesis chapter 1 is that God had an expectation that we would rule well, but He also set up some boundaries. Now, if you're reading Genesis 1, there's not a laundry list of do's and don'ts, is there? There really isn't. But there is a command in there. It's very explicit. God says, you've got all this space to make and do whatever you want, enjoy it, but there's this tree that's off limits. Don't go there. One very explicit rule. You got all this freedom, do what you want, right? And it doesn't take long before man decides to rebel against that one simple boundary that God gave us, you know, that expectation to fit well within this creation that He gave us. And the fourth thing I think you recognize in there is, if you read the rest of that verse in Genesis 2:17, it says, you must in this creation that He gave us. And the fourth thing I think you recognize in there is, if you read the rest of that verse in Genesis 2:17, it says, you must to fit well within this creation that He gave us. And the fourth thing I think you recognize in there is, if you read the rest of that verse in Genesis 2:17, it says, you must boundaries that I gave you, there's going to be some consequences for you. I think the picture you get when you read Genesis 1 is this, that God governs all of His creation, and yet within that, God sort of subordinates responsibility to humanity, that we would govern well where we live. So the picture that you get in Genesis 1 is God governs all of creation, and yet within that sphere of creation here on earth, God says, I want you to govern. I want you to have the responsibility to take and make something of the world where you live. So you get this picture where we have authority to govern the earth, but we're supposed to do that underneath God's ultimate, you know, authority in life. It's interesting because if you think about it, I said, what's God's original intent? So this was before Adam and Eve rebel against God and decide that they're going to do it their own way. And so you get those four things. The interesting thing, though, is, you know, if you read after Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve rebel, you go, well, how did the game change then? How did God's governing authority change? Well, it actually doesn't change that much, does it? God's still the creator. He still governs His creation. He's still got an amazing order for it, even though we oftentimes screw it up. God gave man dominion over the earth. That does not change. In fact, if you read in Genesis chapter 9, the command to Noah after the flood, after there's all these problems in the world, God says to Noah the exact same thing He says to Adam. He says, multiply, fill, cultivate, create. in this world. He gives them the same job of dominion and having dominion and authority. Make something good of the world where you live. That instruction does not change even after the flood. Does it get a whole lot harder as sin has entered into the world? Absolutely. There's no question about it. The third thing we find out is what? That God has an expectation and boundaries for humanity. That hasn't changed either. Rules, especially after Moses, start getting more explicit. There's more of them, more boundaries from which for us to understand what it looks like to govern well. But that hasn't changed either. And finally, the last thing is that God still, just like he did with Adam and Eve, if you violate those boundaries, there's consequences for it, isn't there? It's funny because if you look back at God's original intent for governing his creation, you see that what was true in perfection really doesn't change all that much after man rebels and messes things up. Those same principles about who God is, what his expectations are for us, they haven't really changed all that much. And I would say that it's still consistent even today for us. Those same rules apply. I think there's three simple truths that we can get out of Genesis chapter 1 about God's original intent. The first one is that amazing passage in there where it says that we were made in God's likeness. We were made in his image. And so there's this expectation that we would, in our lives, as we're making something good of the world where we live, that we do it in a way that truly reflects God and his character and who he is. I told you guys a couple weeks ago that I was out on the Navajo reservation with John doing a project with some adults. And Greg, was it Thursday night? We were all sitting out and outside under the stars. Beautiful night. And we're kind of out there in the middle of nowhere. And we're just having a group discussion talking about the trip and what we were learning and what God was doing and stuff. And, you know, my hearing is horrible. And, we're outside and it made it even harder for me to hear. And I'm frustrated and I kind of lean back in my chair and I'm looking up and I had this moment of just, wow, looking at the stars in the sky. I mean, just absolute beauty, and it was incredible. The Milky Way spread out across the sky. Just, it was incredible. And I sat there and I marveled that the Scripture tells us that it's not an accident, that God made all of this. You know, have you guys ever heard those ads, you know, for the star registry? You can name a star after yourself. There's so many of them. There's not a shortage of them. You can go and name a star after yourself. And it's funny because, you know, if you ever, you know, or watch any of the look in the books that tell you about, you know, where the constellations are and stuff. And they've run out of creative names for the stars a long time ago. You know, they've got stars and they're named P-1946C. Harry, James, Beth, and Sally, I guess, are all given up. So they've got these wild names for stars. But, you know, if you believe what the Bible says, what does the Bible tell us? That God made all of these and he governs all of this. And not only that, but God calls each one by name. He holds it all together, and he made it for us to, you know, at least in part for us to admire and to recognize how amazing and powerful and beautiful he is, and to recognize his incredible creative scope. But, you know, I mean, it doesn't have to be nighttime to recognize that. On Friday night, I'm driving around the lake with my wife over past El Tahoe, and it's sunset. And, man, it was incredible, beautiful sunset. And, you know, I moved up here from a beautiful place in Monterey where we had great sunsets and, you know, amazing diversity of creation. That's beautiful. And up here, it's beautiful. And I'm driving around the lake, and, you know, one of the things I try and do is I try to remind myself every time I drive by that El Tahoe stretch to look out there at the lake, you know. Because I don't want to forget what an amazing and beautiful thing that is that God made. And see, here's the thing about that. You can go anywhere in the world, anywhere, any country, and you can find amazing, beautiful, incredible places that are all a picture of God's unique creative ability and his handiwork. And it's diverse. They don't look the same. And see, that's why, you know, that's the thing about us. You go around this room, you're not the same. God made you all different. You all have different skills, talents, and ability. And it's a good thing. God expresses His beauty and creation in us as well. He gives us all different gifts and expects us to use them all different. That's why the world is supposed to be this amazing place when we work well together using what God has given us, right? On the one hand, you might say, well, let's say you're gifted with pottery or painting or whatever, and you go, yeah, you can make beautiful things, and everybody recognizes those are beautiful things, and you go, hey, that's a you've got a gift that reflects God's beauty. But what if you're a contractor? How does that work? You know, how do you make your mark on the world in a good way? I think you still represent God by the way you do your work. You don't cut corners. You know, when you're nailing up 2x4s for a wall or for framing, even though that's going to get covered up, every one you do, you pay the best attention you can to all of the details, knowing that everything you're building and making and creating some way reflects your Creator and the abilities and the knowledge and the gifts that He's given you. I've got a friend who's an entrepreneur here in town, and you know, I think, you know, you go, well, what good is that guy? And does this work here? Well, you know what? He makes an honest living. He's not ripping off his employees. He's not getting rich on their back. He's always thinking about how to expand his business, not just for selfish motives, but he recognizes the more his business grows, the more people he can employ and bless and give opportunity to and improve their life. You know, there's in every area of our life, we have the opportunity to reflect God through the work and the kind of work that we do. You know, Matt is our sound guy up there. And you guys don't ever see Matt, but Matt loves music, and he's got a good ear for music. And so Matt comes and he works with these teams during the week, and he's using his gift and understanding of music and sound and how to put it all together to mix it so that you and I can appreciate it. He's taking an opportunity, something that he loves, and making something that benefits and enriches other people's lives. He's making a mark for God, and even though people don't see him, what he's doing. You know, the band, you take the musicians, they get together, they work together, they each got a unique, different ability, but they put that together and they get this awesome thing, you know, that enriches our lives, allows us to participate in worship in a cool way that we couldn't do if they didn't use those gifts well. There's some single moms here tonight that are my absolute heroes in life, because I know them and I know how dedicated they are to doing the best job they can to raise their kids, you know, and give their kids every opportunity. And they're killing themselves work-wise, trying to figure out how to make time to be able to take care of their kids and spend quality time with them and do special things for them. And I think, I have a hard enough time, and I've got an incredible wife. I don't know how you do it. But, you know, those moms are a picture of, even though it's not easy, they're committed to take in something that God has given them, governing it well and shaping and creating and making something good in the world, making a mark in the world. Whoever you are, we all have opportunities to reflect God, His reality, His beauty through our gifts and talents and resources that we have. Secondly, you know, God has an expectation that we would each govern our own lives under His authority. Remember I said we have all this latitude to do what we want, but God still expects that we would do that in a way that respects His authority in our life. So we look at our lives and we say, how do I subordinate my own personal, you know, my lusts, my appetites, my emotions, in a way that those things don't rule my life, but God does. I recognize I have an anger problem. So you know what? I know that God doesn't want me to get out of control of my anger. So what do? I govern my own life in a way that will allow me to reflect God and His character through the way I live my life, right? I can't tell you the number of times I've had kids say to me, well, you know, I've got these lusts, these sexual urges, these desires. God gave them to me. He can't expect me to restrict them. Oh, yes, He can, and He does. He has a proper way for you to express those God-given desires. There is, it's a good thing, but you ought to govern those lusts, those passions in a way that restrains those things so they don't run your life, but God runs your life. The third thing, I think the truth that you find in Genesis 1 is that there are these boundaries, and God laid out these boundaries for us, and He says, you know what, everyone is going to have to give an account for how you used your time, energy, gifts, and talent. Did you use them? Because God is serious about this. He says, I oversee all this stuff. I govern it. I gave you those resources. Make a good mark in the world, and we'll all be held account for what we do with what God gave us. That's the other reality I think we find in that. You flip over your notes. Last thing in here is, I think it raises three questions as we think about, if we understand properly and you agree with me about God's original intent, I think there's three questions that sort of leave us to wrestle with. The first one is to ask yourself, you know, do I reflect His likeness? We talked about how important that is and His expectation to do it, but I mean, do you ever really stop and think and ask yourself, how am I doing with that? Do I take seriously how I use my resources, gifts, and talents? And am I using those things to benefit myself, or am I using them to live in a way that really does honor the good Creator that gave me all of this stuff? I don't think we spend enough time stopping and asking ourselves that question. And people go, well, what does it really look like to reflect God? Funny you should mention that, because the Bible in Colossians chapter 2, verse 9 says that the fullness of God lived in Christ. That Jesus being God Himself, He's our model. So if you want to know what does it look like to reflect God's goodness and His character, we have an amazing model for us to see what that looks like. Greg Laurie, who is the founder and president of Harvest Ministries, he says it like this: just because you attend church or engage in certain religious activities doesn't necessarily mean that you're a Christian. The Apostle Paul instructed those in the early church to examine themselves to see if their faith was genuine. So how do I know if you're a Christian? How do you know if I'm one? There must be evidence. Jesus said, by their fruits you shall know them. You have to be able to look at your life and see. If someone examined your life, would they find any spiritual fruit? That's that idea of, you know, is the Spirit of God living in you and changing you, making a difference in your life? Hard evidence to prove that you're a true follower of Jesus Christ. Or let me put it another way. If you were arrested for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? By evidence, I don't mean how many Bibles you own or how many bumper stickers you might have on your car with Christian sayings on them. I mean hard evidence. If your family members, your neighbors and coworkers, the people that know you the best, if they were interviewed and asked the question is, and you put your own name in here, in your opinion, a real Christian, we might not be happy with the response. The only way others can tell whether you're a Christian is by your works. This is key what he says right here. While all the good works in the world won't save you. In other words, God doesn't say, oh, look how good you are, you earn salvation. If that was true, Jesus wouldn't have had to die on the cross because we all could have earned salvation. Right? That's not what it's about. That's not what he's saying here. But he is saying that if you wonder if Jesus is really in your life and you're living under God's authority, there ought to be a way to tell. There is reasonable evidence that someone is saved. The second question I think that we ought to ask ourselves is, are you governing your own life and those under your care? Most people that I talked to, even just this last week, and I bet even just in your own mind, as soon as you hear the word government or govern, most of us tend to think of civil government, local government, state government, or federal government. And that's kind of the only way we tend to think about what it means to govern something. But that's really that's kind of a recent phenomenon in history. The word govern has generally first been talked about and expressed in that way of thinking about restraining your own passions in life, that you would govern your own life first and foremost. Not that there would be an outside entity that catches you when you get out of control, and then the civil government kicks in and says, you played outside the rules, now you're going to be punished for it. God's first expectation is that we wouldn't get to that point. God's first expectation is that you would govern your own life. He gave us lots of latitude, but that doesn't change the fact that His desire for all of us is that we would exercise some self-restraint in our own lives. A good example of this, granted, it's old, 1824, Noah Webster's Dictionary. The original Webster's Dictionary says this, when it talks about government, it talks about direction or regulation, but listen to the very first reference that he used to define what government is all about. He says, men are apt to neglect the government of their temper and passions. He's using it in a very personal way that you ought to exercise some oversight in your own life. And I think that's God's expectation for all of us. He says, I gave you all this, but he did set up some boundaries. He says there are consequences if you go outside of that. Exercise some restraint in your own life, even if it's difficult. And you know what? Here's the deal. We live in such a victim-oriented society that I am so sick of people not taking any responsibility for their own actions. But all they want to do is pass the buck. I'm an alcoholic because my parents were alcoholics, so it's not my fault. I'm engaging in premarital sex. It's because the urges that God gave me, and I can't restrain myself. My kids are out of control, and it's because of the media and the messages that they're bombarded with, and their friends that are corrupting influences on them. And talk about that public school. And parents want to blame everybody else for why their families turned out the way they have. And they don't take any personal responsibility. But God never said it would be easy. God said life is full of all sorts of challenges. But you know what, man? That's true for all of us. God's expectation is that you would take and exercise some personal self-control. Self-control is a huge word in the Bible. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. Notice what he says here. So the first expectation, I think, is that God has is that as we live under his authority, as he governs, that we would learn to govern our own lives to some degree. But listen to this other definition he gives in here. He says, the exercise of authority by parents or a household. The idea that all of us have some influence in the world. You may be a parent, you may be a boss, you may have influence over some younger people. I think you ought to ask yourself, if God's given you a sphere of influence, are you governing those responsibilities well? God takes that seriously. He has an expectation that you do that well. I love what he says. This is the sentence that he uses. Children are often ruined by neglect of what? Government and parents. You have spheres of influence, and you ought to govern, be responsible for those things well. I guess it was yesterday or the day before, Barbara Billingsworth, who was the mom in Leave It to Beaver, and I wasn't alive when Leave It to Beaver was on television, but I've watched reruns of it and stuff. I was listening to an interview that she did she must have been in her 70s or 80s, but man, she was really sharp. I mean, she knew what was going on in the world and in life. One of the things that she said that was it was so cool, as she was talking about the TV show, she said, you know, they tried to make it a reflection of what life was really like, about the good fruit of being good parents and having a healthy home, and the incredible blessing that a happy family is. But she, in the same breath, she went on to say, just like in the show, in real life, it's a huge challenge. And see, I think that really reflects well what I'm talking about in terms of governing, that it's not easy to do. But when we do it well, it's incredibly rewarding. And it's a beautiful thing when we exercise self-restraint and control well in our own lives, or we shepherd whatever sphere of influence God gives. It's a beautiful thing. It can bring a lot of joy. It makes a good mark in the world. But that doesn't mean it's easy, does it? She really nails that. I told you, this is really what this is about is self-control. And man, there are so many good verses in the Bible about self-control that should guide and help us recognize that God's expectation is that we would exercise some restraint and control in our own life. The last thing is, I told you earlier, we're all going to have to give an account to God someday for how we used, our gifts and our talents and our resources that we have at our disposal. And like I've said, I mean, I don't want to pretend like it's an easy thing. It's a hard thing to do this well. And I think that's why it's so critical to find other people that love God and love us and want God's best for our own lives. And that we have some really close friends that we adopt that will help us to live this out well in our own lives. I've got four guys in my life that I've known for a number of years, a long time, and we talk real regularly. And those guys have played an amazing role in helping me keep myself together and keep my eyes on the task and think about why I'm living the way I'm living and why I'm making the choices I'm living. And they're an amazing blessing for me. And they I think, help me understand that I'll give an account someday, so why not start working on having some people that help me live well now, so that when I do give an account and I stand before God, not only will it be a joy because I'm in Christ and Jesus has forgiven me, but it'll be a joy because I'll stand before God and say, you know, thanks that I got to see all the amazing, beautiful things, and I got to experience the richness of life and the way you designed for it to be lived. And so I want other people that are going to help me do that well. I was reminded this week that the person that helps me the best stay focused on God is not any of those four guys, but it's my own wife. I've got this incredible partner that wants God's best for me and helps hold me to account and pushes me and motivates me to be the best person that I can be. If you're married, I hope that you're that person in your spouse's life. I hope that you're married to someone like that. If you're not married yet, don't marry someone who isn't a genuine partner that can play that role in your life, because it's so critical to have people like that. In fact, if you go back, we were talking about God's original intent. I think that part of the key to understanding why things got so messed up is because Adam and Eve didn't play that role well in their life. When they're in the garden and Satan comes along, Adam is there and Eve and Satan are having this conversation, and Adam says what? Yeah, nothing. You're right, he doesn't say a thing. There was not a genuine partnership there where he was looking out and holding Satan and his own wife to account. And you see, how did God make the whole thing? Why wasn't Adam okay by himself? God said what? It's not good for man to be alone. You need a partner in this whole thing. That's God's design, is that we're not made to go it alone in life, but to have other people that would help us and help us understand what this is supposed to look like. And that's, you know, that's why this church is such an amazing place, is because I'm exposed to all of these people that are doing it well, that are using their gifts and their unique talents to honor God. And it inspires and encourages me to go to find another level in my own life of what that looks like, to use my own resources and gifts in a way that honors God. That's why the church is important. We're made to work together, to encourage each other, to live together, to hold each other to account. That's what it's all about. That's all I have to say about that. So go do it this week in your life. All right, if our band will come back up, we'll spend some more time worshiping. Thanks for your generosity that helped make this church the awesome place it is, especially with our offering, which if the ushers will come forward, we'll take our offering now too, that helps us pull off some of the neat things we get to do here in Tahoe and the ministries that we get to support around the world. God bless you guys. Have a great week.